Welcome to VI Talk, sharing ideas, information, and support.
Hi everyone, it's Jo and I have with me Dawn.
Hello.
And it's a pleasure to welcome to VI Talk Simon Mahoney. Hiya Simon.
Hi Jo.
Hi Simon.
How are you today?
Oh, very well. I've got a bit of a sniffle, but there you go.
Oh, bless you.
Goes with encroaching age, probably.
So you're a writer, but you're here to talk a little bit about yourself as well, aren't you? So do you want to tell us a little bit about your sight loss?
Right. I developed glaucoma at the age of 38, which is such a long time ago now. I really can't remember how far ago it was. I'm now 73. And it was quite well contained until 2010. And for some reason or other, I caught uveitis, which is another condition caused by fierce sunlight. And the uveitis sent the pressures in my eyes sky high, where normally they should be between 12 and 21, and they went up into the 50s. By the time I got the uveitis under control and could do something about the pressures, it was too late. I mean, you could almost hear the optic nerves being munched away. So it came to the point that, the point of no return, really, and my eyes just... Well, my optic nerves just decayed to the point that now I have absolutely no sight whatsoever. So that condition has been now for about 2 years. I've been unable to see anything for 2 years.
That's such a shock, isn't it? I mean, suddenly that quick to happen, and it's a lot to come to terms with, isn't it?
Well, it was, especially as I was looking after my disabled wife at the time. And it was very difficult for her as well. I think sometimes we overlook the fact that the people who care for us and love us and are with us, they are as equally affected by a disability or an impairment such as sight loss, because they too have destroyed expectations. They too have the pain of watching someone they love go through a fairly traumatic experience, and particularly with sight loss, I think, because sight loss is such a fearful thing. In fact, it's so fearful that people refuse to think about it. In fact, my belief is that people even refuse to consider that their eyes are part of their body, because the thought of losing them is so fearful. They rather forget them. They can only imagine what it's like for us. Well, I know what it's like for me, and I can assure you it was nothing like as bad as she imagined. So, I mean, she was going through double agony. Mm-hmm. And I think this is probably true of all the people who care for us. And of course, they are then in a position where they have to take on unexpected burdens, and that creates tension within the relationship. It causes an adjustment of a power relationship. It makes it very, very difficult for everybody involved, not just the person who's got the sight loss.
Yeah, definitely. But you decided, didn't you? You after what you'd been through, you decided to take a very positive approach, didn't you? Do you want to tell us a little bit about that, how you came to that decision?
Well, many years ago, I was a social worker running a day centre for people with disabilities. I thought I knew something about disability then. Yeah, right. Yeah, let's not go there. one of the techniques we used was what we sort of rather grandly called scriptotherapy. In other words, getting people to write about how they felt about themselves and their situation and how they felt about things that had happened. And we found this was extremely cathartic for them. So I thought, well, it seems to me that with my training and background, that I was really well placed to start writing about sight loss, and it would also be cathartic for myself. So instead of sight loss becoming a nightmare journey, if it were, as you were, not that I like the word journey, as I explained before, what it became was a fascinating adventure. And I was able to develop the skills. For example, I had to teach myself how to touch type and use a computer without a mouse, which is quite an interesting exercise, to actually initially write an article, which is in the Blind Veterans website, and then expand the article into a book, which I called Descent into Darkness. And that contains a narrative of my procession into blindness, and it also contains a lot of what I found, what I wasn't told, and how I dealt with the general ignorance and fear, and the little tricks and techniques that I developed off my own bat in order to be able to cope with what was happening. For example, I developed a whole set of exercises to give me confidence in the use of my hands again, because one of the things that happens when you lose your sight is that you lose all confidence in the sense of proprioception. In other words, the sense that tells you where your different parts of your body are in relation to the rest of it. And I found that to begin with, I was just knocking stuff over all the time. So I sat down and I thought about it, and I devised a set of exercises to get that skill back. I can now flawlessly go into a cupboard and take out what I want. I can go to the right cupboard, I can go to the right level, I can go to exactly the right spot in the cupboard, simply because I know exactly where my hands are and what they're doing. That's just an example of the kind of thing that's in that first book.
Okay, and you're now currently writing a sequel to that book, aren't you?
Yeah, it's called Winging It Blind, or No Longer a Victim.
Can we ask a little about that one, or is it all hush-hush at the moment?
No, it's not hush-hush at all. Some of the first book is obviously going to be in it, because I have to relate back to it. So for those people who haven't read the first book, I have to sort of reiterate what was in that, what I'm relating back to. But basically what it is, it's the development of my thinking about sight loss in the light of 2 years further experience. And it's got a lot of discussion about, for example, one of the chapters is entitled Limbo or Renaissance, which is developing the idea of acceptance, going beyond mere brute acceptance of what's happening and putting up with what's going on, to actually embracing it, redefining yourself, and if you like, actively undergoing a rebirth in your new persona as a person who has accepted you can't see, and just getting on with your life. And the alternative, of course, is just to grimly accept it, but that just leads to very little happiness and a sort of dreadful limbo where you're just sort of enduring what's going on. So, I mean, that's the kind of level I'm dealing with sight loss in that particular book. I mean, another chapter is called Disabled or Disenabled, and I'm arguing that the public perception that just because that one part of you is wrong, or sorry, not wrong, just because one part of you is disabled or not working, in my case, my eyes, it doesn't mean that the rest of me is unable to function perfectly normally, and that basically we should stop colluding with the idea that just because there is something wrong with one part of our body, that we are as personalities and individuals disabled as such. We're not. We're the same as anybody else, just as that some bits don't work. And if you can point out to me somebody who is perfect, then I'll accept that, yeah, fine, I am disabled, but I think everybody has a disability of some description. And let's face it, people who think they're perfect, that in itself is a disability. So
yeah,
what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to open up the discussion. I mean, if somebody wants to write to me and say, you're barking mad, fine. I'll write back and say, okay, why? What's your point? You know, I'm saying this, you're saying that. Where do we meet in the middle? You see what I'm saying? I'm trying to get a debate going, because at the moment, people will not talk about sight loss because it's too horrifying. The government are ignoring, well, everybody's ignoring the fact that we're sleepwalking into a sight loss epidemic of practically biblical proportions. If you look at our toxic lifestyle, if you look at our toxic environment, if you look at the increased longevity, we're going to find ourselves in a not too distant future where nearly a quarter of the population are going to be either suffering a greater or lesser degree of sight loss or looking after someone who has it. And nobody seems to recognise that or think it's important.
I think some people do. I mean, yeah, I understand what you're saying. You know, facts and figures are not, you know, do show it, don't they, in the eye clinics and so on and so forth.
Well, I look at it this way. When I started to lose my sight, RNIB was saying that between 3 and 4 people an hour being diagnosed with sight loss. They're now saying that up to 250 people a day are beginning to lose their sight. That is frightening in 2 years.
Absolutely.
It's horrifying. You know. And I mean, when we look at the increased UV, when we look at particulate pollution, when we look at, well, even fluoride in the water, which is, as we know, is a toxin, that affects the body as well. When we look at the effects of long-term stress, I haven't actually investigated that yet, but long-term stress affects the body in various ways. I can't believe that the eyes get a free ride. If we actually look at diabetes, we look at obesity, we look at smoking, they're all contributing to some total sight loss, and it's quite horrifying. I mean, I had absolutely no awareness of this until I began to lose my own sight. I think most people are in the same situation.
So you, as well as writing about your sight loss, you also have written a book on cooking and how to cope in the kitchen, haven't you?
Yes. Back in March, just before lockdown, my wife suddenly died. And I was faced with a fairly stark situation. A choice. My choice was to say, well, that's it, I can't do it. I give up and I've got to have care now. I've got to have meals on wheels or something. And I've got to be looked after day and night, hand to mouth. Or I could just get a grip and say, right, I used to be able to cook. Let's get back in the kitchen and get independent. And I chose to do the latter. And in the last 4 or 5 months, I've developed so many little techniques. And people were saying, that's amazing. How are you doing that? And I was thinking, well, it's not amazing. I'm just doing it, you know. But I began to realise that what I was doing was considered to be rather unusual. And I decided it might be worth writing a book about it in order to encourage other people who've got sight loss to have a go at cooking. And of course, it's a book about how to rather than what to cook. And as such, is heavily laced with hot tips, what I call hot tips, which are basic survival tips. It's also a great emphasis on safety, the lazy person principle, organisation, preparation, and how you actually finally get round to constructing your meal and cooking it.
So that must have been quite a tough journey for you, with, you know, obviously, you know, you're grieving for the loss of somebody you love and who's been a big part of your life, and then to be able to turn it all around and do that, that's quite an achievement, isn't it?
Well, to be honest, I think it was, I had to undertake something fairly monumental, or just pine away. You know, I love my wife very much, and when she went, as quickly as she did, it was a hell of a jolt to the system. And I was determined that I was going to turn what was a dreadful situation into something positive. I think you have to do that. You know, I've got this dreadful, trite little phrase that I trot out. Basically, it's saying that when you have a disability, you have a choice. You can either choose to be a victim of a disability or a victor over it. And I choose to be a victor over it.
Good for you. Can we be cheeky and ask for you to share one of your hot tips out of your book to tempt people into reading the whole thing?
Right. Number one. I'm trying to think which one to choose. I'll give you two. All right. Okay. Is that all right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's great.
Right. Number one, I work within the confines of a tray for the simple reason that as I'm blind, I can't see any mess I make. So all the mess is confined in a tray, and when I finish preparing my meal, I just tip the rubbish into the bin. Mm-hmm. That ties in with the lazy man principle. It means I'm not scurrying around trying to find all the bits I've lost. Right? The second one is quite a cute one, which I heard on Kitchen Cabinet, which I thought, oh, I do like that. And it's, you know, when you've got a lemon and you want to get some lemon juice.
Yes.
The damn pips always get in the way, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Not if you stick a knife in it and squeeze the lemon, because the pips stay inside.
Interesting.
isn't it a cracker? And it works.
I've heard that before.
It works. I tried it the other day when I was doing the filming for East Midlands Today. And I thought, I'm going to give this a try. I'm going to show off in front of the cameras. And it worked. I was amazed. It was brilliant.
Brilliant.
I think the hottest tip of all is, quite honestly, this is an overall tip, I suppose, is the lazy man principle. You get yourself organized in such a way that you don't have to move when you're preparing food. So you can focus on what you're doing, because you're dealing with sharp knives and all the rest of it. You can focus on what you're doing, and you're not moving around, because you and I both know that if you can't see, any movement has got the potential for an accident.
Yeah.
So what you're actually doing, it's almost the old-fashioned idea of management by objectives. You set your objective, which is to make a meal, and you then identify the sub-stages in the process of making that meal, and you deal with each stage one at a time until you come to the point where you bang it in the oven. It just makes things logical, reasonable, safe, and doable. And that last bit is the most important bit, is doable.
Can I ask, do you have any specialised gadgets in your kitchen? You know, such as liquid level or bump ons on your oven or anything like
that? Right. Liquid level, I don't like. I tell you why. I don't like the idea of having a cumbersome, unwieldy kettle full of boiling water and trying to pour that water into a small target that I can't see. So what I've got is a 1-cup kettle, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that is far better because it just pours in a measured amount and then you pour your milk in. I've got very few gadgets. All my equipment is analog. In other words, it's got knobs on it and you know the position of, and you swing it around to a certain position and you know that'll give you a certain performance. The only thing which isn't analog is my microwave, which is a talking microwave, which was surprisingly cheap and very effective. I do have a set of kitchen scales which talk to me, but I don't use them for the simple reason I've developed my cooking so that I can write about it for people who haven't got gadgets. So I don't actually have any gadgets to speak of. The only gadget I've got is a talking microwave and the 1-cup kettle. The rest is all perfectly ordinary gear. Because at the end of the day, I think we have to go for, if you like, people who may not be able to afford these gadgets because they do come a bit expensive sometimes. So I'm trying to make it as ordinary and as commonplace as I can. It's merely the real gadget, if you like, is the level of organisation involved. Does that make sense?
It does. So do you have any other books on the, in the future? Have you got any other ideas for books coming up?
Right. I'm thinking about writing a series of children's books about my cat Spitfire. Spitfire, when we got her, she was a kitten, and the person who brought her just dumped her on the floor, and the four dogs gathered round, great interest, and this spitting fur ball was hissing and going absolutely ballistic in the cat carrier.
Yeah.
And then later on, when she developed from a kitten, she was fast, highly manoeuvrable, and purred like a Merlin engine. And on top of that, to quote Sailor Milan, one of the aces during the war, she's a lady and a real killer, because I'm always getting dead mice laid on my chest as a tribute. So I'm thinking along the lines of writing children's stories about Spitfire. I'm also currently writing the story of my family. The stories about my family, because I'm very aware that I know very little about my grandparents. I know nothing about my great-grandparents. So I decided that I know a fair amount about one of my grandparents. So I'm starting the story from the stories from my grandfather's time, which will be my grandchildren's great-great-great-grandfather. So they'll have the family stories going back for well over 100 years.
Oh,
so I'm doing that at the moment as well.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, it's all the sort of family stories, you know. The other thing I was thinking of doing was, when I was actually relating my father's life, and I was talking about it to someone else, I said, good God, that would make a fantastic film. And I thought, actually, it might make a very good novel. I mean, Dad was, he was kamikaze twice on the Illustrious during the war. He was ambushed twice in Malaya. I mean, what happened to him just went on and on and on. I mean, he led a charmed life. And coming up from South Africa to Portsmouth in the middle of a war in a very elderly, more or less helpless cruiser, absolutely loaded to the gunwales with gold from South Africa, a ship 50 miles to the east of them, when they were near the Bay of Biscay, was sunk without trace. And obviously the Luftwaffe thought that was his ship, and they sunk this other ship by mistake. So I think that might make quite an interesting novel.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, make quite an interesting novel, I think. So, yeah, I mean, I've really got the writing bug now, because before I lost my eyesight, I was a professional artist. So now I'm painting with words instead of paint.
Good artist. Mm. Yeah, that's really good. So you're a very creative person.
Well, yeah. I like to use my mind. It's the only thing the government can't tax or influence.
So before we finish, where are your books available?
Right. I've only got one at the moment which is available,
mm-hmm.
and that's on Amazon. Mm-hmm. Or if people want to email me direct on Simon at wingingitblind.com, I'll be very happy to send them a book, and they can send me a check or put it in my bank account, I don't mind which. And the book, Descent into Darkness, retails at $9.95. But as Amazon are such robbers, I could probably let people have them for $8.
Right. Okay. Is it available on Kindle for anybody who
It is available on Kindle. And also, in case people aren't aware, Kindle HD Fire have a text-to-speech facility.
Mm-hmm.
I presume you knew that.
Yeah, but no, thank you. That's a good reminder for people. Yeah.
I actually downloaded the Kindle version from the file I sent to Amazon. I didn't pay for it. I thought, no, I'm not paying for my own book. Anyway, why would I spend 10 quid on that rubbish, you know? Oh, dear.
So when will Rabbit, as you quaintly call it, be available?
Well, I'm hoping maybe 5 weeks. I was going to say it's with the publishers. Not, I'm the publisher. I have my own publishing entity called II, which is EYE Publishing, which I thought was a nice little whimsical title for it. And I go to a self-publishing or self-production firm. And they edit it for me, and they organise distribution and the typesetting and the printing and converting it to e-book and all the rest of it. And I'm hoping it's with them now. They've had it a week. I know they're actually editing it as we speak. Hopefully, we're talking about maybe 5 weeks, 6 weeks. But I'll certainly let you know anyway.
That's great. Lovely. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much, Simon. It's been a pleasure.
Well, it's been a joy to talk to you as well, Joe. Thank you very much.